Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Ogilvy stage. If you're just joining us this morning, welcome. If you've been here a little while, thanks for hanging out with us. I'd like to welcome to the stage Charles Duhigg from New York. Charles is an investigative reporter from the New York Times, and he's going to talk about his book this morning, The Power of Habit. So a little bit about the science of habits, how they form and how they can be changed. And Charles first became interested in the power of habits and the science behind habits while he was a reporter in Iraq. And he noticed an army general analyzing videos of riots. You may have read his excerpt in the New York magazine, which New York Times magazine, they picked up a little excerpt from his book, which was about how Target knew that a teenager was pregnant before her father. He might speak to that a little bit, too. So, Charles, take it away.
Thank you so much. And thank you, all of you, for coming out, particularly since I think half the people who are still in their bedrooms didn't remember that today is daylight savings, and so they're behind it by an hour. My name's Charles Duhigg. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. As my kind introducer mentioned, If you've read anything about The Power of the Habit, it's probably a piece that was in the Times Magazine about Target studying shopping habits and using those to predict which women are pregnant. But the book is actually about much more than that, and so I was just going to walk you really briefly through it. The one thing I would ask is, if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me, because the best part of doing things like this is when people tell me that they think I'm an idiot and then tell me why. So if you think I'm an idiot, throw up your hand and feel free to tell me that I am. Someone's already starting? Good, thanks. So the book that I wrote is about the science of habit formation. I got interested in this about a decade ago. And let me make sure I'm doing this right. And let me just define what a habit is really quickly. A habit is not an instinct. A habit is a decision that you made at some point and then stop making but continue acting on. And a study about a decade ago at Duke University tried to figure out how much of our daily activities are habits. And so they followed around a whole bunch of people, and what they found was that about 45% of the daily activities that almost everyone does are habits. They might feel like decisions, but they're not. It's this automatic behavior that's automatically unfolding in your life. And so some researchers at MIT in particular got interested in why habits exist from a neurological perspective. And in the last decade, our understanding of the neurology of habit formation has been completely transformed. And so the story I want to tell you today is the story of Febreze, which, does anyone here use Febreze? Are you guys familiar with Febreze? Okay. So it's one of the most popular products in America and on Earth. But in order to tell you what Febreze is and how it works, I have to tell you a story about a rat. So about 12 years ago at MIT, they developed a technology where they could put electrodes into the brains of rats and observe the neurological activity while they did anything. And so they took a number of rats and they did this to them. And then they stuck all of them in the world's simplest maze. As you can see, it's a T-shaped maze. And what would happen every single time is the rat would be dropped in the maze behind a partition. There would be a click. The partition would move. The rat would be free to run up the maze and look for the chocolate. And the first couple of times that this happened, the same thing happened every single time. The rat would go in, the click, the partition moves, the rat starts moving through the maze, and it looks like the rat is just kind of wasting its time. It would scratch on the walls, it would sniff in the corners. Eventually it would find the chocolate, but it didn't even look like it was looking for the chocolate. It looked like the rats were lazy. But when the researchers looked at the neurological activity, what they found was the rat's brains were working hard the entire time. Every single time the rat would scratch on the walls, the scratching centers of its brain would light up with activity, and it would sniff, and the sniffing centers would light up with activity. The rat was thinking the entire time, trying to learn how this maze worked. So they do this again and again. They drop the rat in over and over and over again. As you might imagine, eventually the rat learns how to run through the maze faster and faster and faster and find the chocolate. In fact, from a neurological perspective, this behavior becomes a habit. And this is what they found was happening inside the rat's brain. The bottom graph there is what happens inside the rat's skull after the habit forms. What you'll notice is that the neurological activity goes down. This is the neurological signature of a habit. When a habit starts unfolding, your brain actually stops thinking. You start working less. And this is a huge evolutionary advantage, because it means that rather than having to concentrate every single time you back your car out of the driveway, you can just do it automatically after doing it 5 or 10 times. Humans and almost all mammals have succeeded because we have this ability to form habits. But there's something interesting about this habit formation, which is if you look more closely at this graph, there's two spikes in the brain activity. At the beginning, when the rat would hear the click, and at the end, when it would find the chocolate. This is how habits work. Scientists have called this the habit loop. Every single habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for the automatic behavior to start unfolding. The routine, which is the behavior itself. And then a reward, which is when our brain kind of shakes itself awake and says, should I remember this pattern for the future? The reason why this is important, and actually a hugely transformative discovery, is because for centuries, people have focused on the behaviors of habits. When we think about a habit, we think about the routine or the behavior. But it turns out that the cue and the reward become neurologically intertwined. They create a sense of craving. And this craving is what drives the behavior in the first place. The cue and the reward are the secret to creating or changing habits. But we've really only begun understanding this in the last 10 or 15 years. Just to go over really quickly, this neurological insight has actually revolutionized a number of fields of study, including, for instance, our understanding of the addiction of cigarettes, right? Cigarettes are actually only physically addictive for about 100 hours after your last smoke. Once the nicotine is out of your bloodstream, we know from medical experiments, you're not physically addicted to cigarettes anymore. But the reason why people have this craving for a cigarette with their morning paper 2 years or two decades after they stop smoking is because the habit is reasserting itself. The same thing is true when RIM and other companies began making their smartphones vibrate in your pocket, or when Outlook began dinging every single time you got an email. Researchers found that all of a sudden, checking your smartphone, which a couple of people are right now, becomes incredibly addictive, right? If it buzzes in your pocket, you can't ignore it. You got to pull it out and see what it is. It's the same basic neurological function that's happening there. And in fact, you can use the same basic science to create habits. So in one of the largest studies of creating exercise habits that occurred in Germany, they found that people who created an obvious cue, they put on their shoes before breakfast, or they would always run when coming home from work, and who gave themselves a clear reward, which was a piece of chocolate after working out, were much more likely to develop exercise habits. Which is counterintuitive, because the whole reason you're exercising is to lose weight. And if you eat chocolate, it doesn't make any sense. But what's happening is that after about 2 weeks, people would stop eating the chocolate. Their neurology would learn the reward of endocannabinoids and endorphins that occur when you exercise. But their brains didn't know that at first. And so in order to sort of trick their brain into forming a habit, they had to provide a reward, which was the chocolate. If you like chocolate. If you don't like chocolate, it doesn't work. Rewards have to be genuinely rewarding. So the point here being that this habit loop is kind of revolutionary. But as I mentioned, the story I wanted to tell you today is about Febreze. So Febreze is this amazing product. If you've ever used it, you can spray it on any fabric whatsoever. It makes smells disappear. It's actually called HPBC. This is not actually what it's called. It has some name that I can't say. But these are the initials. So this is what we go by. And the way that they discovered this is that there was this researcher at Procter & Gamble, one of the largest consumer goods companies on earth, who was a smoker. And he's working with this chemical because he thinks he can add it to Tide to make everything better and cleaner. And he comes home from work, and his wife greets him at the door, and she says, "Hey, did you quit smoking today?" And he blows up because she'd been harassing him to quit smoking for like the last year. He's like, "No, why are you always giving me a hard time about this? I didn't quit smoking." And she says, no. "It's just that you don't smell like smoke today." And he realizes he had been working with this chemical in the lab. It had somehow made the smell of smoke disappear from his clothing. He goes back to Procter & Gamble. He tells his bosses. They're ecstatic. Because if you can make bad smells disappear, you can sell $1 billion worth of whatever does it. They think they're going to make $1 gazillion. And they call it Febreze. And they give it to a team of marketers. And it seems to marketers that the habit loop here to make Febreze into a daily habit seems totally obvious. The cue is bad smells in people's lives. The routine is use Febreze. The reward is no more bad smells. They all assume they're going to, literally one guy told me he assumed he was going to buy a Ferrari within 6 months from the bonus he was going to get on selling Febreze. They decided to test it. They decided to test it in a couple of test markets. They run these ads. This is the first Febreze ad.
"Guess what the kids call Dad's easy chair?
The stinky chair.
You know, I have a stinky chair problem too. His name is George.
Well, now there's a way to get bad smells out of fabrics for good.
It's called Febreze. It's new. And you won't believe how many places you'll find to spray it.
See, Febreze helps clean fabrics in a way you never could before.
And it's not just covering one smell with another.
Exactly. Just spray Febreze. Its patented cleaning system finds the smell trapped in fabrics and gently cleans them away as it dries.
Once it's dry, the smell's gone. for good.
Febreze, check the Montreal.
And check this out.
It's safe, from dress blues to teddy bears. Febreze cleans bad smells out of fabrics, for good.
I wonder if they'll call it the sleepy chair now.
One of the things I like about this advert is that you never really realize that the late 90s had a visual aesthetic until you see commercials from that period. You're like, oh, I used to wear that too. That was a terrible choice. Anyways, they launch these ads. They figure, this is going to be great. We're going to make a killing. It's a total flop. Febreze is literally the largest money loser in Procter & Gamble's history. In fact, they are losing so much money on it that they take the marketing team and threaten to send them to the Nicky Clark hair care products, which is like Siberia for packaged goods. Anyone here use Nicky Clark? Exactly. So, the team starts to freak out. It's filled with a whole bunch of habit specialists. These are people who got hired because they have PhDs in habit formation. And they all go and they have this meeting and they talk about what they're going to do if they get fired. And they decide, one more chance, we're going to go interview people who have Febreze and figure out why they're not using it. So they find a woman who owns a number of cats outside of Phoenix. And they go and they visit her house. They walk into her house. The smell of cats are so overpowering that one of the P&G researchers starts gagging when he walks into her living room. In fact, a lot of people, does anyone here own cats? Okay, you know, hey, a couple cats, it's not bad. This woman owned a lot of cats. But here's the weird thing, is that she was kind of a neat freak. Her house was totally spotless, except for this overpowering smell. So they sit down with her in the living room, and they say, you know, what do you do about the scent of cats? And she says, oh, if it gets bad, I spray the Febreze, it's great. And one of them says, how often do you do that? And she says, oh, once or twice a month. And the guy who started gagging when he walked in says, well, what about right now? Do you smell the cats right now? And she says, no, I have the best cats. They don't smell bad at all. This, Procter & Gamble realizes, is the problem. And you all know that this is true, right? If you have bad scents in your life, you become desensitized to those scents. In fact, if you smoke, your olfactory nerves become damaged to the point where you can't smell smoke anymore. The entire cue that was supposed to make this product a daily habit wasn't even being noticed by the people who needed it the most. And they couldn't tell any reward associated with it because they never knew that the smells were there. So, one of the Procter & Gamble researchers goes back and they start looking at all these videotapes. This is stock footage. I don't think you'll notice anyone looking quite this cheery when they're vacuuming. But Procter & Gamble actually has the largest library of videotapes of people cleaning on Earth. Procter & Gamble will go in, they'll give you like half a year's worth of free toilet paper if you let them install cameras in your living room, which is not a great deal if you ask me. But they have all these videotapes of people cleaning. And so what they start looking at is all these cleaning rituals, right? And what they notice is that when someone would vacuum the carpet afterwards, and again, you probably do this, afterwards, they would look at the carpet and kind of smile at it. And they would look at these other things. They would notice that when people made their beds, they would often take a moment to look at the smooth comforter and kind of sigh. And I'm just going to show you this photo because, you know, the number of times that I'm with my child and I want to clean the windows together, there's really nothing more meaningful for a father-son bonding. But that being said, and I know that all of you have done this, have you ever noticed that when you actually wipe the mirror, after you do so, you look at your reflection in the mirror and smile at yourself? Right? There's this moment after you clean. Cleaning has its own habits, its own cues and routines and rewards. And the reward there was that people wanted to celebrate that they had finished the cleaning process. And the researchers said, that's what we can make Febreze part of. Febreze isn't going to take out bad smells. Febreze is going to make things smell good, make things smell as good as they look when you're done cleaning. So they went back to the laboratory. They had spent millions of dollars creating a spray that was powerful enough to kill almost any odor. Then they spent millions of dollars creating a perfume strong enough to withstand Febreze so that they could pour it into the formula and that when you would spray Febreze, it would have its own scent. They decide to unroll this in the same test markets, and again, they come up with a habit loop. But this time, the cue is the cleaning ritual itself. The routine is that when everything's all done, you spray Febreze on what you just cleaned, which doesn't need Febreze because it's clean. And the reward is it smells nice. You have a sensory celebration or reward for just doing a good job of cleaning your house. They enroll it in the same test markets. I'm going to show you the commercials. Now, what's interesting is you'll notice in that last commercial, they mentioned bad smells a lot. See if you can tell how many times they mentioned bad smells.
Get your fix of freshness. Febreze. Anytime, anywhere, it's a breath of fresh air.
Shouldn't I be the one on the couch, doctor?
No.
Okay, that's good.
Get your fix of freshness. Febreze. Anytime, anywhere, it's a breath of fresh air.
Let me show you just one more. If you were a Zen monk, this is the advertisement that you would create.
What do you think it means?
Maybe it's Morse code.
Fix of freshness with Febreze. Anytime, anywhere, it's a breath of fresh air.
If you knew nothing about this product, you would think that these are literally the weirdest ads you've ever seen in your entire life. If you came from outer space, you would have no idea why anyone would use this unless they're psychotic and like to smell fabric on a regular basis. Maybe it's Tourette's. But they unroll these, and Febreze sales explode. Within the first year, $200 million worth of Febreze was sold. Today, Febreze is a $1 billion a year product. Procter & Gamble doesn't have that many $1 billion a year products. But Febreze is one of them. And it's exactly because they got the science of habit formation right. They figured out the right cue and the right reward, and then people started buying this stuff. In fact, now, if you've seen Febreze advertisements, they can actually tell you, by the way, it kills bad smells, too. They just had to wait 7 years to advertise what the product actually does in order to start selling it. And that's basically it. You know, we're running out of time, and I want to take questions. The rest of the book goes into how this science applies to other settings. You know, for instance, organizational habits. This is a coach named Tony Dungy who remade his hit two football teams, both of which ended up winning the Super Bowl, although one of them not under Dungy right after he left, by focusing on players' habits and the cues and the rewards that they had on the field. There's this thing called the golden rule of habit change that he focused on, which is that you have to keep the cue and the routine the same and change cue and reward the same and change the routine. We know from laboratory studies that's the most effective way to create lasting habit change. This also explains how Alcoholics Anonymous works. AA is essentially an unscientific program that was developed by people who had no background in psychology, but the reason it works is because it attacks the habits around alcohol use. It also explains, for instance, why some people have gambling dysfunctions. We know from MRI studies that essentially they habitually see a near miss differently than everyone else. And if you have any questions about that, I'd love to answer it. But the point is that understanding the habit loop gives you a way to not only change your own habits, but other people's habits. If you focus on the cue and the reward, you gain this enormous influence over how behaviors unfold. The book is essentially like a science and business book. It backs it up with a whole bunch of studies. But what you can hopefully carry away from this is, if you study the cues and the rewards in your life, or in your company, or your organization, you gain a place to start changing habitual behaviors. And that's it. If anyone has any questions, I'd love to take them, particularly if you think I'm an idiot. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's a whole chapter on willpower habits, and in particular how Starbucks uses this to do its training with recent high school graduates. But it's the same thing for kids. So one of the really interesting studies, this came out of the University of Rhode Island, is that if you teach kids when they're about 5 years old to habitually make their bed every morning, in sixth grade, for some reason, they do their homework earlier. If you as a family, eat dinner together, kids have better attendance. So some of this kind of makes sense, right? The families that eat dinner together are probably also the same families that get their kids to school on time. But another part of this is that there's these things called keystone habits. Some habits seem to matter more than others, particularly in children's lives. And so when you begin targeting keystone habits, you set off a chain reaction that makes other patterns more malleable. Exercise is the best example. People who start exercising habitually eat better. And that makes sense, because you feel healthy, you want to eat better. People who start habitually exercising also use their credit cards less, and they do their dishes more often, which makes no sense whatsoever, except that for most people, exercise is a keystone habit. It seems to make other patterns more malleable. And so in kids' lives, if you can recognize the keystone habit, I think you can transform them. Yeah. So the question was cues and rewards in the context of websites. Yes. I would actually say buy the book because there's a lot in there. And in particular, a lot of what we know is from video game designers, right? Video game designers are very sophisticated in their understanding of reward schedules. And I'll just give you one thing to carry away. The number one thing that video game designers have learned, and I think websites have also learned this, is a reward has to be genuinely rewarding, right? So if you just give someone a badge, or if you give them the mayor of some place that no one has ever heard of, that's not particularly rewarding. A reward has to have genuine reward to start habit formation. And so I think one of the reasons why Facebook and Foursquare have been so successful in giving rewards is because there's a real social authority connotation in what the badge that you receive or whatever Facebook gives you, the social update. There's a social reward embedded in that that's very precisely engineered to be genuinely rewarding. Yeah. Right. So the question is, when does essentially a behavior become a habit? How frequently does it have to occur? And when does the reward become intrinsic? So there's this like myth that I'm sure you've all seen on the internet that like takes like 21 days for a habit to form or 28 days, right? That does not make any sense. I'm sorry to say, there's no magic number, that it differs from habit to habit and person to person. If you want to start a chocolate habit, it will take you literally 7 minutes. If you want to start an exercise habit, it's a little bit longer. And so the answer is that there is no magic number. But we do know from neurological studies that habit grows stronger and stronger over time. So the more you do a behavior, the more that the neural pathway associated with that behavior, essentially the walls of it become thicker and thicker and thicker, which makes it easier for electrical currents to run along that particular path as opposed to an alternate path, which is why that behavior feels easier and easier and easier. And to answer your question about the reward, when does the reward become intrinsic instead of extrinsic? It just varies from habit to habit. But the more you do it, the stronger it'll become. Let me just take two more if you guys don't mind. Yeah. So the question is, how well do people know what their cues and their rewards are? And I assume you probably guess what the answer is. Not very well, right? So there was this study that was done by this guy named Pete Goldwitzer, who's really interesting. He does work on something called implementation intentions. He's at NYU. They took a whole bunch of people who are in a healthcare plan, and they brought them into rooms where they taught them about the importance of exercise. Half the groups got an extra lesson. Literally, the lesson was the lecture or the talk I just gave explaining the habit loop and then asking them to write down two cues and two rewards that they would associate with exercise. That group exercised twice as long in duration over the next 6 months than the other group. Most people can identify what the cues and the rewards are pretty easily. And in fact, in the book, we kind of go into like the details of just how to figure this out within your own life by running a couple of experiments. But because most people never think about habits in terms of cues and rewards, you're totally blind to them. And the truth of the matter is your brain stops working during a habit. So you don't pay attention to what's going on around you. But they're not hard to discover once you sort of have this framework for saying, this is how I want to analyze my behavior. I'm getting the sign, so let me just... Do I have time for one more, or should... One more, and then I'll be signing books if anyone wants to come and ask a question. Oh, sure, yeah. So I was in Iraq. The question was about the Iraq incident. My day job is I'm an investigative reporter for the New York Times. I actually have a series out about Apple, which some people might have seen in conditions in factories overseas and stuff like that. Thank you. As everyone with their iPad. Yeah, that's very kind. We're very proud of doing this work about Foxconn. Anyways, a decade ago I was in Iraq. I wanted to go to Iraq because I thought it'd be cool to be in a war zone. And let me tell you, it is not cool to be in a war zone. Turns out it's the opposite of cool. And so my goal when I got there was to figure out how not to get shot. And I heard about this army major that was doing these experiments on a base where he was not getting shot at. And he was looking at videotapes of Iraqi riots. And he figured out that there was kind of this pattern to a riot that would happen. So he goes to the mayor of this town named Kufa, and he asks the mayor, hey, can you take all the kebab sellers out of the plazas? And the mayor, who's dealing with suicide bombing, says, sure, I'll take the kebab sellers out. So the next time, a couple weeks later, crowd starts developing. Looks like it's going to be a riot. 119 people have been killed in riots in Kufa. It's very dangerous. They call the base, the major. And about 5:30, 6 o'clock, the crowd is growing over a couple of hours. The spectators who are there to watch, who usually get drawn into the riot, get hungry. And they start looking for the kebab sellers, and there's no one there selling food, so they go home. And once the crowd starts thinning at the perimeter, the people who are one layer in start looking around and thinking, everyone's gone, I'm going to leave too. Within 45 minutes, the entire crowd was gone. There was no riot. And in the 9 months that the major had been there, there had not been one riot. So I asked him, how did you know this? Like, this has been going on for months and years. How did you know that taking these guys away would change things? And he explained to me that the military is the greatest habit experiment on the face of the planet. Basically, when you're in the military, are there any veterans here? Okay, yeah, so you know this far better than I do. The military is all about teaching you these habits about how to think under battle, how to get along with people you might not stand, how to communicate with your spouse when you're overseas. And he said that once he sort of understood to look at people as habits, these cues and these rewards, it became obvious what to do in Kufa. So, again, thank you all so much. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming out. I'll be on. Thank you.